This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 5, Fielding in the Box. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we get down and dirty with some field settings, and we talk about one which has come up with a new name of The Box. So we'll find out what that is on the show. And we also help a 12-year-old with his trigger move. Should he be triggering at that age? Gareth has got some thoughts on it, and so has Sam Lavery. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome again to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to coaching better cricket, to playing better cricket, to better cricket all round. And how are we going to do that? Well, let me explain a little bit to you. This week, my name is David Hinchliffe, and I run things. And alongside me, it's a couple of men who can really help you out with your cricket. First of all, it's the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, David. It's good to know that this week you're David Hinchcliffe.
Yeah, well, it varies. So, you know, on a Saturday, I might be somebody else.
Well, I've heard that about you.
But that's for a different podcast. And also, hopefully, this week, he'll be the person that I'm talking about. It's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Lavers, is that you?
It is. Sorry, I just had someone slam their face against the door, the window of the door I'm in, the room I'm in, but never mind, he's gone.
Okay, it's a good quality of student you've got there.
Scholarships are available, everybody, if you want to get in there.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about cricket, and specifically, I was thinking about this week, the difference between putting in a performance and putting in a performance under a pressured situation. I had a little back and forth on Twitter in the week gone by with someone who said technique is all well and good, but if you can't do it under pressure, then it makes absolutely no difference. And I thought that was an interesting thing that we could talk about a little bit more. Specifically, I guess, how good players under pressure do that, and then how people who aren't so good at it can learn to get better at it. So let's explore that first of all, Gareth. The guys who are, you must have seen this close up, the guys who are really good under a pressured situation, what is it that they do that makes them so good under that situation?
Well, I think most of them have a bit of calm around them, really. So they understand that pressure is there, and they accept that there's pressure is there. And in whatever context, they also look at themselves and see what skills they have to deal with that pressure situation. And often the people who don't respond particularly well in those pressure situations don't have faith in their skills to be able to deal with it. So, for example, you know, if you're facing a Malinga or somebody who's very good at bowling Yorkers at the end of an innings, at whatever level you're playing at, if you don't feel that you have the skills to be able to deal with those deliveries and what that bowler is going to throw at you, then you're going to feel as if you are, under pressure even more than the situation puts around you. So often it's the calm guys, but it's also the guys that have got the skill sets to be able to deal with whatever the circumstances are. So for me, pressure would have been as a batter, I'd have felt very comfortable in most pressurised situations. For example, chasing runs down in the last innings of a game, I was always very confident at doing it. And however much the pressure went up, I felt as if I had a good chance of doing it because I was a decent player when the ball spun. But equally, if it had been starting a four-day cricket against the world's fastest bowler on a pitch with a bit of green to it, I would have felt incredibly under pressure and probably buckled because my game wasn't suited. So it's a combination of character, but also the skills and tools that you've got in your bag that can be applied into that pressure situation.
So, Lavers, do you think that anybody who is not good at dealing with pressure and coping under pressure can adapt their game and learn how to do it more effectively?
I definitely say so. It's something that is probably can be regarded as a skill in the sense that it can be improved. If we think about, like, as Gareth has said there, what people are strong at is staying calm, and how can we stay calm? So sometimes people will be able to remove themselves from the situation. So if people can remove the noise, as it would be referred to in a scientific basis, from what's going on, so the factors that aren't actually relevant to what's going on. When someone's running in, you know you have to score a certain amount of runs or a certain amount of runs over a series of time. But the other things, like the crowd or what the opposition is saying to you, or various other factors, aren't actually relevant to you, yet they're the things that often build the pressure upon you. So if you can have a logical approach to it and understand what's relevant, understand that it's still the same situation essentially as you'd experience in a training environment or any other game, however the outcome or the stakes involved are slightly different, but it's still bat against ball, and whether you're on one side or the other, if you can remove those variables that aren't relevant from the situation, then you should be a little bit more controlled in your attitude and your mindset.
It's a tricky one, especially if, like you said, Gareth, once you know how to do it, you know how to do it. But until you know how to do it, you don't know how to do it, if you see what I mean. If you don't think, if you're not sure whether you've got the ability to take someone on because you've never done it before, and then you do close out a game and you think, okay, well, you know, I can do that, then it becomes something you become more confident at. But until you've done those things, it must be difficult to have that faith that you are going to do it, because you've got no evidence that you have done it before.
I completely agree. And this comes back, I suppose, a little bit to the notion that I have that when you practice your skills, you're doing that in throwdowns and bounce feeds. I'm talking as a batter now, but as a bowler, you know, it can be bowling at targets, it can be doing your drills, it can be doing your med ball throws, all of those things to try and get your skills up to a level. Then we take those skills and we put them into a middle practice. And we talk about middle practices a lot here. And middle practices, to me, are about helping to build your confidence and therefore your ability to deal with pressure. So if you practice those scenarios over and over again and you learn from your mistakes, and then all of a sudden, you know, getting 60 off five overs, which seems impossible 10 weeks ago, then becomes a 50-50 chance of doing it, then there's a good chance that you end up doing that in a match at some point. And what I find is that we shouldn't wait for a match to prove to us that we can do this type of stuff. That's why we should use our practice more effectively. So it's that middle bit from doing all the drills that everybody always writes in to Pitch Vision about and says, you know, give me some drills. Get the drills right and then test it in a middle practice or in a specific net to see whether it stands up. Because that's where you start to prove to yourself that you can do it. That's where you start the evidence process. And then when you get out into a pitch and that situation puts itself around you, you have the confidence to be able to deal with that pressure that's placed around you. My favourite ever and proudest moment, I suppose, as a coach dealing with pressure or helping players deal with pressure, was when I was commentating on the box. We were chasing 274 against a bowling attack that had Nintini and Wakar Yunus in it, and a Somerset side were 50 odd for four, chasing 270 odd. The game was dead in everybody else's views, and every time they asked me a question on the box, I said, I've got great faith in everybody down the order because they've practiced this situation over and over again. And when we won by four wickets later in the day, the two not out batters said, we've done this 100 times before in practice. And that is exactly the way that we should do things. So to me, that middle bit of practice is crucial when it comes to handling pressure, because you can't just go from skills to doing it in a game and expect to come out on top. And equally, it always disappoints me when people prove to themselves that they can do it out in the middle, because they should have practiced it in a different way beforehand.
I think that's really good. I think one of the key words I picked up on was evidence there. And people, as you said, David, don't have evidence that they can do this. But the evidence they do have is that there are thousands of people out there who are also in the same situation who weren't sure if they could do it either. So everyone has to succeed for the first time at some stage. So you can take a little bit of confidence from knowing that those great players over the years, so your Michael Bevans and Mike Cussies and people that who've established reputations as world-class finishers in this instance, or I mean the situation doesn't really matter, But you can take heart from the fact that these guys were in the same situation as you, where they had a skill base and they didn't necessarily know whether or not they could apply it to the situation when the pressure came on. But once they've done it the first time, look at what they did. So there's no reason you can't follow that.
Let's wrap up this section with the yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more that the team want to say. Of course, controversy last week when Mark Garraway didn't answer yes or no, but we've got past that. The papers have finally calmed down. And let's have strict discipline this week. First question. Tough times require positive people to make things happen.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. Matches are won in the last third of the game.
Yes.
No.
Third question. Hip rotational power is the key to fast bowling and power hitting.
Yes.
Yes, and spin and throwing.
Oh no. The red tops will be all over it. Every week around about this time on the show, we answer the listeners' questions, or perhaps their questions from people who read the Pitch Vision Academy website. We don't discriminate in any way. We just pick out the questions, we answer them as best we can, and then we choose a winner, which is a prize of an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can email in your questions to us by using coach@pitchvision.com. First person who did that was Dan. And Dan says, I'm interested to know your thoughts on field settings for leg spinners in 2020 cricket and how to attack, but not to go for too many runs. And if you'd like, I'd also like to hear your thoughts on 2020 field settings in general. So I think that's very, very interesting, not only from a field settings front, but Lavers, you've also done an article this week regarding 2020 bowling and how it's becoming more important among coaches than it used to be, whereas, you know, you were just the bowling machine before, but now there's a little bit more of an emphasis on it. So maybe we can talk a little bit about where the leg spinner fits into all that.
Well, I think you've seen in recent times in Big Bash cricket that anyone who has an element of mystery to their spin can be extremely effective and can be can create a big amount of doubt in the mind of the batter. So that wrist spin factor is something that's becoming more and more prevalent and something that's really doing some damage. One of the things I talked about in my article is that the need for a unit as a bowling attack rather than individual guys who can bowl very well, because often what people will do is they'll work extremely hard and they'll set themselves a target if there's a star bowler and they'll look to make up in other areas. So maybe in terms of investment of their money in 2020, they go heavily at one cricketer, but that as a result, they maybe don't have the same depth in their fourth, fifth and sixth bowlers that they might need. So the great example is obviously the winners there with Perth, who did extremely well, and he's not a leg spinner, but as your wrist spinner, Brad Hogg has done extremely well, and actually had a brief chat with him yesterday on Facebook, just saying well done for everything he's achieved again at the ripe old age of 43 or 44, can't remember how old he is now, but he's done extremely well, and he's got that element of mystery, and he's also got that understanding of his own game, so he's very aware of how he works. He can set a field to what he's planning against any person on any pitch, really. So he's got a really good understanding of how he's going to do it. That also can then rub off into the bowlers around him. So not necessarily all spinners, but Perth seem to have played two spinners at least, or have two or three options of spin in most games. There's obviously an element of success which is coming directly from the quality of spin bowling that we can have. One thing with field settings is obviously a bowler's skills are only as good as the field that's set, and a field is only as good as the bowler is bowling to it. So don't expect just by setting a good field that you're going to have great results. You've still got to bowl to it, you've still got to commit to it. One of the things you've got to be honest about is your ability as a spinner when you're setting your field. So if you feel you are going to bowl six balls in exactly the right area and you can put it exactly where you want and you can spin the ball different directions, then your placements as a result are going to be very different to if you're aware that every over you're going to drop a ball short, or every over you're going to just lose control. So it's difficult to give specific fields, but I would definitely say that if you get your skill set right, then you have a lot more options with your fields, and you can start to be a little bit more creative, and you can start to be very flexible in terms of the pitch you're on and the person you're batting, you're bowling against.
Gareth, are there any... what's the best way to put this? Let me ask it in a different way. What would be the kind of default leg spin 2020 field at, for example, at the school first 11 level?
Well, I've just written one down, actually, because I've been scribbling on a bit of paper. So, good question, David. Excellent X-ray eyes from Wales. Well done. I've got here... So if I go leg side first, I've got a short, fine leg, and that's because, you know, people are getting really good at flipping the ball and getting low, and even against pace now, and to do it against a spinner is pretty easy for them. Even with the ball spinning away, people are doing it pretty well. So I'd always have that guy in, because generally, if a ball goes fine on the 45, it tends to spin away from deep backward square, so it's always going to be three or four. Which is obviously a high-scoring ball. So I'd have a short, fine leg. I'd have a deep backward square, again, because the ball's going to spin further behind square, so I would set my square leg behind square to counteract that. Then the interesting position for me, the two interesting positions, is a guy in the box. So in the box, I talk about having somebody level with the stumps on the one there. Now, what tends to happen with leg spinners, and we saw this a lot with left-arm spinners, is that they'd actually drop that guy onto the boundary and they'd encourage people to hit against the spin, okay, and try and knock it into square leg or knock it into mid-wicket, because there's a massive gap there for people to push the ball into. And occasionally people will get leading edges back to the bowler or back to cover. So you've got flexibility to either have that guy on the... that guy on the one, or to actually drop him back on the boundary and leaving the whole of square leg through to mid on as a an easy run score if somebody can play well into the spin or against the spin. And then your mid on again, it could be somebody on the edge of a circle, or it could be somebody on back on the fence. So straight away, you've either got on the leg side three guys in the deep out of the five that you're allowed in 2020 cricket, or two men, depending on what you do with your mid-on depth and what you do with the depth of the guy at straight mid-wicket. And then in mid-off, you'd probably have your mid-off back on the boundary for large parts of it, but again, with a new batter or somebody you know can't hit over the top, you bring those ones up to save the one and to apply some pressure. A key fielder for any leg spinner is the straight extra cover. Again, the offside box man, level with the stumps, they're going to be, that's a huge high traffic area, and you want your best fielder or one of your best fielders in there, because they're going to get the ball drilled at them a lot off front and back foot. I'd always bowl with a deep cover, just to give myself a little bit of cover, and also with the way that people are now bringing in the reverse sweeps and the hard switch hits, I'd have a deep cover out there. And I would bowl with two men behind square, or one on square and one at sort of 45 on the offside, which is the position that we see Maxwell trying to hit the ball up over the top, as Sam alluded to earlier. So that would be my basic field. And any field is a starting point. But that's a really basic field that we can move certain people around in terms of their depth. But in terms of alignment, you wouldn't need to do too much with that, unless you had somebody of incredible talent like a de Villiers or a Maxwell on top of their game. But interestingly, with Maxwell, there was the innings where him and Peterson got their team home the other week, and then one of them got out, the other one got out, and it ended up with that scrambled near run out off the last ball. The leg spinner came on to bowl, and it was the last throw of the dice, and Maxwell got out to it. And there's a bit of a prevalence to Maxwell getting out to leg spinners, particularly when he's set. And I don't know whether that's a mental thing or not, but often he would see these fielders, particularly behind point on the offside, as two to go over the top of. When the ball's spinning back into the bat, he finds it very easy to launch it up over the top, but when the ball's gone away, he hasn't. So that's my basic field, and it might be worth putting that up on the site as part of the show notes.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that. I like that field, Gareth. And one of the things that I notice, especially at club level, is a lack of... I don't know whether it's just not being aware of the match situation, or settling into something and not really thinking about it too much. But a lack of changing the field when something happens, when a new batsman comes in, or there's some kind of a change, and then the field it's remained set for the guy who got out, and it's easy runs for the new guy who comes in because everybody's still on the boundary because the other guy was smashing it all over the place. I see that happen especially with mid-off, for example. It's important to play in the match situation that you're playing in and not the one that was the case two balls ago.
I think it's a classic mistake that people make, because everybody gets together for that wicket, don't they? You know, so you all have that huddle in the middle of the pitch for that wicket. I always say that you can celebrate for 30 seconds and the next 30 to 90 seconds, depending on how long it takes somebody to come in, is all about what do we now need to do. So well done, we've had 30 seconds of celebrating that we've done a great catch or we've built pressure up and caused a wicket. But the next bit is about, right, what do we do next? And normally it's a new batter on strike, and that it infuriates me when I watch exactly what you've just explained, where the same field for a guy that's just got 70 and you've gotten caught on the boundary is the same field for a bloke that hasn't had a bat for 3.5 weeks. You know, you're just thinking, let's get our head around that. So to me, it's about that huddle time and how you use that effectively.
Next question is from Sham. I can assure you, though, he is a real person. And Sham says, I'm 12 years old and I've started to trigger my batting against fast bowling, and sometimes I get my trigger wrong. So should kids of my age trigger or not? I've been opening for my school, which is the topmost cricketing school in Mumbai. I stick around but hardly get beat, but I'm hardly able to score as well. So what should I do? So a couple of questions there. Are they related? Trigger moves, I guess we'll start with that.
Bob Woolmer, who is one of the world's best coaches in the last 20 years, fantastic cricket knowledge and a very open mind to stuff. He says that trigger movements aren't what, it's about when, and that when varies for the individual. Now, he said that because he passed away in 2007. He said that in 2006, at a time where people were pretty much coaching maybe one trigger movement or the one that they did. And he was encouraging coaches back then to be a little bit more flexible about it. So do you need a trigger movement? Not everybody does. An example being Matthew Hayden, who didn't have a trigger movement when he batted, yet was facing bowlers bowling 90 miles an hour or up towards 90 miles an hour and sometimes more than that. The way that he would trigger was if he felt that his thighs were strong and his core was strong, it was more of an internal trigger rather than an external or a foot movement or whatever the case may be. So he didn't trigger and it worked very well for him. We see examples of people like a Graham Smith or a Kevin Peterson who trigger early. So you see them go bang, bang with their feet, and then there's a pause before the time where the ball is released, and then they then have to move. These guys are the ones that want to load their legs and load their feet and then to explode, like they're in the starting blocks at a 100-metre race. They want to explode out of those blocks to then meet the ball. Then you have people like, for example, an Andrew Strauss, who would be shuffling across the crease and almost moving at point of release. And what they're doing is trying to get into the rhythm of the bowler. So their foot movements will happen in relation to the bowler. And again, it will help them. So a trigger movement is there, whether it's an internal one like a Hayden, whether it's an early set position like a Peterson or a Graham Smith, or whether it's a constant pitter-patter movement, I suppose, across the crease like an Andrew Strauss. The reason why they're doing it is to start the engine. It's to start the neuromuscular system so it's ready for action. And as long as your trigger movement is yours and it's timed in relation to what you want to do and it's firing your engine, then you're going all right. And what I would say is maybe experiment with each one of those and find out which one is most you.
And that is a 12-year-old. You'd have no problem with a 12-year-old experimenting with lots of different trigger moves at all, Gareth?
No, absolutely not, because they've got to find their own one. I mean, why do you want to trigger in the first place? Is it because everybody else is doing it, or is it because the ball speed is getting too much for you to stand still, or whatever the case may be? There's got to be a why at the beginning, otherwise there's no point in doing it. But at some stage, whether he's 12 or whether he's 15, it will be something that most cricketers want to experiment with, because they'll see people on the television doing it, they'll hear the commentators talking about it, so they'll they'll want to incorporate one. The challenge is that the commentators will generally talk about the one that maybe they adopted as a cricketer, and that could work for you or it might not. So what I've given you there is three different options to have a go at yourself, and you don't have to do those in games. That's not the time to practice it, to master it. Obviously you can do it in visualization, because that's always a really good way of doing it. See the bowler coming in, try those, each one of those out, maybe actually put those movements into place while you've got your eyes closed and you've got that picture in your head. You can do it in relation to somebody giving you throwdowns, somebody bowling off a shorter distance, if it's somebody like me who's a bit older but can't get the ball down the other end quite as quick anymore. Or you can have it and do it in nets. But give each one of them a go and you'll find out which one works for you. And it goes back to the whole Bob Warmer thing, is it's not about what trigger movement, it's not what you do, it's about when you do it. So you're either going to be somebody who holds their position internally like a Hayden, walks across or has lots of movement prior to ball release, almost immediately before ball release like a Strauss or a Peterson or Smith that move and then set like they're in the blocks at the start of 100 metres.
Levis, do you think there's any tie to his other problem, which is that he can stick around, but he can't score quickly? Or do you think these are totally separate problems?
Oh well, it might be that he is triggering, or he's using the wrong type of trigger, or he's triggering where he shouldn't be, and as a result, he's not generating the power, and he's not getting the rhythm that he would like. So there could be a tie between the two. As always, it's difficult to tell the individual case, but one of the key things is experiment. So have a look at what your performance is like in a net situation. Are you feeling that your trigger's working, you're generating power, you're hitting targets, you're hitting gaps, etc., to the level that you'd be happy to do? And then if that is the case, then actually the trigger probably is working and it's something else that's match specific that's not working for you at the moment. But if you find that your skill set is in a training situation is similar to that in a match, and you do find you struggle to, even though you defend well, you maybe don't generate the power you'd like, then it might be worth looking at experimenting and bringing in alternative methods. So, experimentation is probably going to be the key, and utilising your net time and any open practices you do have will be the key. And obviously, reviewing as honestly and as effectively as you can do. Review personally, review with the coach you've got, review with your teammates around you, get as many good opinions from people you trust as you can, and see where you can go from there.
In India, I watch a lot of setup coaching go on in India when I'm over there. And generally, it's one coach standing in front of a 40, 50, and sometimes I've seen more than that, people standing there holding their bat, and he'll teach them their basic setup, and they spend a lot of time on that. And it's a very sideways on setup, and it's a very technically correct, as I look around at the cricket coach's manual from 1998 on my shelf, it would be very reflective of that. And back in 1998, cricket was seen as a sideways on game, and we now know that cricket may start as a sideways on game, but ultimately rotational forces are really important, whether you're bowling, batting, throwing or hitting. And in the context of being able to hit the ball powerfully, which it sounds as if this lad is struggling with a little bit, I wonder whether the stance and the setup and the ethos around the sideways on game that a lot of people in India are exposed to may be inhibiting his ability to use that hip that we talked about in the yes-no questions. Because if you can bring that right hip, if you're a right-handed batter, or left hip as a left-handed batter, through a little bit better, looking at somebody like an AB de Villiers, of having the feet not necessarily, the front foot not necessarily always go into the line of a ball like we always used to be coached, then you can facilitate that hip and the power will increase up through a kinetic chain. Give that a go. Open up your front foot a bit, let your right hip come through and see what the difference in the output off of the bat will be. Soapbox time here on the show. It's a nice sunny day in Somerset. I'm not sure what it's doing in Cardiff, so watch your step as you climb up those big steps, mate, and stand up and give us a minute of your time.
I want to hark back a little bit to something we talked about early in the show, and that is practicing. Around this time of year in the UK, there's lots of clubs getting into nets and getting into sports halls and doing the things that they've done for the last 20 years, for the last 30 years, and that is to have a net, to have some people bowl, to have some people bat, Everyone gets a few minutes if they're lucky, and then everybody goes home and does it all again the next week. This is fine. There's a place for nets, but there's also a place for pushing the nets back. And I think that doesn't happen enough in club cricket. It still defaults to the option of everybody having a bit of a hit without any particular plan. And if you go in with a plan, if you go in with something that you want to do, then there's no harm in pushing the nets back for a few weeks and doing something else, doing some fielding, maybe having a game of indoor cricket, trying to ramp up that pressure and ramp up those skill levels in different ways to what you might have been doing for the last 10, 20 or 30 seasons. And that is the end of the show for another week. We are wrapping things up here, but before we finally disappear, we're going to just decide on our winner of this week's competition, which is of course the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we had Dan's question about field settings, and we had Sham's question about trigger moves and slow scoring. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
God, that's a real toughie this week. Real toughie, because I think they're both fantastic conversations that we had some really good discussions about. But I'm going to go with Dan this week, because I love tactics. I don't think that people look at that enough. And hopefully by listening to the show and listening to the answer to Dan's question, that will start to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's very often that you default to whatever the standard thing is. You know, if we just do this, if we hit the top of off and you know, the batsman's going to play straight, then everything will turn up roses. But if you think about it a little bit more, then perhaps you can come up with some things that will give you an edge. I mean, if that's 1% or 5%, then it all counts, doesn't it? Now, if somebody was listening to the show and they wanted to send in their question and have their chance of winning the prize, Gareth, what would be the best way for them to do that?
David, they could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. You can also get us on Twitter by finding at pitchvisionacad there. And you can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can send in a question to us via there or just take part in the conversation that's always going on. If you want to listen to this show every week, you can subscribe by getting your favourite podcast app and doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in there. Brand new logo for the new series. And if you want to do it the old school way, you can do that as well by going to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link for the RSS feed if you fancy doing that. But also in the podcast link, we've got some links to different podcast apps for different platforms. So if you want to use something a bit more up to date, you can do that. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Thanks, guys.